All right. This is if you're new, this is you're kind of at the end of the movie, last message of five, and through the life of David. We've been learning some significant lessons from the life of David, and as we kind of move into this morning, I thought maybe it's just me, maybe I'm alone in this, but I wonder if any of you have ever noticed that life rarely goes as anticipated. You've got a plan. It's a well laid out plan. Plans are good. I'm married to a planner. In fact, after 30 years of being married to a planner, I have learned to become a planner, because if I didn't, she was going to kill me in my sleep. Because there's a plan, there's details. In fact, I wasn't sure we're going to make it through the first month of marriage, because I would meet new people and hey, come over for dinner, and she's like, whoa, there's not a plan, and there's food in the refrigerator and all that. And so so that didn't work out really well. Now the irony is, after 3 decades together, I've become more of a planner than she is, which is funny because I loved her. I want to become a planner, and she's like, I should be more flexible, like Chad, ready, fire, aim. And then we flipped, and so now she drives me crazy. So it's God's sense of humor. But plans are great. Plans are great. Everybody should have plans. But in the end, reality is greater. Reality always wins. In other words, things don't always turn out as planned. Sometimes it's because of things other people do. Sometimes it's because of things that we do, decisions we make. But in the end, what this means is some of our dreams won't come true. Some of our dreams can't come true. That the two of you, as I've interacted with so many, as it turns out, may not live happily ever after. Or perhaps the second marriage is starting to feel a lot like the first marriage. It means perhaps that maybe you won't ever need to purchase a high chair. Maybe your dreams not coming true means that you will never get the opportunity to walk a daughter down the aisle. Some years ago, I spent many days in the hospital sitting next to the bed of a friend who was never going to see his daughter off, his two beautiful daughters off for their first date, or see them off to prom. To walk them down the aisle, to hold their first grandchild. Because he was 33 years old, he went in for a minor surgery, and when they opened him up, they immediately closed him back up because they discovered that this healthy guy's body was filled with cancer, and a month later, he was dead. For some of you, dreams coming true means not coming true means maybe that prodigal son or that prodigal daughter, they're not coming home. Maybe you're not going to get into that school. Maybe it looks like money is always going to be tight. Maybe it looks like the dream job isn't going to be a dream job after all. And the thing is, depending on your religious background, if you have any religious background at all, as we begin to see things are not going to go in the direction that I thought they would, the ways that I dreamed, there is this internal sense of panic and maybe even anger or frustration. And you direct that towards God, because maybe you kind of feel like God promised you, or that God owes you. You feel like maybe you played by the rules, or you tried to do things the right way, or you raised them right, or you behaved, or you waited. You did everything that you could to do things right and play the game right and live the right way, and yet your dreams, the way you dream them, are not coming true. And there's this internal sense of struggle. And at times it looks like God has granted somebody else your wish. In fact, I've had people say to me, why is it working out for so-and-so, but it's not working out for me? Why is it working out for them, but it's not working out for me or for us? And so today, as we wrap up this series in the life of David, we're going to ask an important question that the life of David answers for us. And when I was talking with the entire worship team before service today, they're like, well, that sounds like a really fun service. It's like, what do we do when our dreams can't come true? What do we do when our dreams can't come true? And yet, this is the reality that we live in. Now, as we saw over the last few weeks, when David was in his 20s, he had a plan, and yet Psycho King Saul decided that David needed to die. He's on the run. He's in the wilderness. Everything's upside down. And then he did what so many of us do when we feel like our plans are falling apart. He panicked. And when he did, he made, like we do, bad decisions. But in his case, people died. But during this season of his life, he learned a very important lesson that we talked about. But then as king, he would undermine his own dreams coming true. And the lesson he learned in an earlier season of life that he applied then is a lesson for all of us. So about 22 years after David became king. So now he's in his 50s. For us, 50s is pretty fine. Back in that day, not so much. He gets up late one night. He looks down. He sees one of his trusted men, one of the commanders of his army, one of his friends. He sees Uriah's wife bathing. And, you know, from childhood, I always thought it was a little ironic. Her name was Bathsheba. Just maybe that was just me. You know, but she's taking a bath, and he calls his servant over and says, who's that? And the servant says, that's Uriah the Hittite's wife. Wife. Did I say wife? It's his wife. And David says, send her to me. And you can't say no to the king. So Bathsheba comes to David. Everybody pretty much knows the story. They spend the night together. They probably spend multiple nights together. Then one day, Bathsheba sends David a text. I'm pregnant. David texts back, I can fix this. He calls for her husband to come in off the battlefield, gets a report of what's going on, and then they hang out and says, hey, well, as long as you're here, before you go back, just go home, stay the night. But Uriah is a righteous man. He spends the night on the ground outside the palace gates. David finds out he didn't go home. He brings him in, why didn't you go home to your wife? And he's like, how in the world am I going to go home and be with my wife when my men and the Ark of the Covenant are literally like out in the open fields and my men are dying? There's no way. So David's like, okay, spend one more night. David gets him good and drunk. David gets him drunk, points him at home. He doesn't go home. He sleeps outside the gates again. So the next morning, he calls him in, and David creates this, basically he creates a death sentence. He creates a message to Joab, who's the commander of the armies, and he puts a seal on it. He puts it in Uriah's hands and sends his death sentence with him. And it's delivered to Joab. And basically, the message is, hey, when you're in the heat of the battle, I want you to withdraw from Uriah so that he is killed. And Joab does what he's told because you can't say no to the king. It was a death sentence. And then Uriah dies in battle. Bathsheba mourns. David brings him in. She's pregnant. And it looks like David is this magnanimous king, just taking care of a soldier's pregnant wife. He's going to raise somebody else's child. He marries her. Everything's good. David has managed the outcome, which we all try to do. We try to manage the outcomes, except in a world where there are slaves everywhere, there are no secrets. The walls have ears and the walls talk. So some time passes by. Eventually they're married. The prophet Nathan makes an appointment with David. He comes in. He tells him this made-up story about this particular individual. And David gets all worked into a lather. He's all angry about this individual in the story. And Nathan says, glad you're all angry about that because you are that man. And David is broken. And David allows the law of God to break him. But here's the problem. Whether you're a Christian, whether you're a religious person, whether you're not, every sin comes prepackaged with a consequence. It just does. Every sin comes prepackaged with a penalty. And that day, as David began to mourn his own sin, Nathan says to him, this is what the Lord says. Out of your own household, I'm going to bring calamity on you. Although you did this in secret, what I will do, I'm going to do this in broad daylight before all of Israel because you're the king. And you're accountable to an entire kingdom. And because I'm going to bring about a consequence that everybody in the kingdom knows about. And then David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. See, as flawed as David was, as flawed as he was, he never abandoned God's law. He broke it, but then he would allow the law of God to break him. And once again, we see him acknowledging his fault and surrendering to the law of God, the will of God. He says, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan replies, the Lord has taken away your sin. You're not going to die. But there is going to be an unavoidable consequence for what you did. You slept with a married man. And then to try and hide it, you had an innocent man murdered. And then you attempted to lie to an entire nation. So a year goes by and nothing happens. 2 years goes by, nothing happens. 5 years, nothing happens. Finally, 10 years later, the consequence takes hold and David's entire world is turned upside down. David's oldest son was a young guy named Amnon. And Amnon, because he was the oldest son, he's first in line to become king of Israel. But Amnon was consumed with lust for his half-sister Tamar. We're in Arkansas, So Tamar and Amnon, they share one parent, but not two, right? So Amnon, he just can't get her out of his mind, and apparently, He's done everything he can to get her attention with no luck. He's just consumed with lust. So he pretends to be very, very ill, and he sends David a message and says, hey, is it okay if my sister Tamar prepares a special meal for me? David's like, sure, no problem. So she brings the meal over. Amnon sends everybody out of the room, and then basically he begins to pursue her. He says, hey, I'm not really sick. I just want to be with you. He tries to talk her into going to bed with him, and he begs her and tells her, like, I'm not really sick. And she says, no, my brother. She said, don't force me. Such a thing should not be done in Israel. Do not do this wicked thing. But the text tells us, but he refused to listen to her. And since he was stronger than she, he raped her. And the next verse is just so gut-wrenching, because the text says, then Amnon hated her with an intense hatred after he raped her. In fact, he hated her more than he loved her, and Amnon said to her, get up and get out. So she's devastated. She's because in this culture, she knows that her life is ruined forever. She will never marry. There are no secrets in the palace. In fact, there's no secrets to the extent that David ultimately hears. He finds out what happened. He finds out what his oldest son did to one of his daughters, and he's furious. So you know what he did? Nothing. David did nothing. Now, we don't know exactly why David didn't do anything, but maybe it's because he felt like he lost his moral authority, because, again, he knew his past. So, you know, who is David to tell people how to manage their private lives after what he had done? And now we're introduced to another one of David's sons, Absalom. Now, Absalom is Tamar's brother by the same two parents. Tamar is destitute, so he takes her into his home. She's just broken. And he, too, does nothing. In fact, he doesn't even speak to Amnon. He just ignores him and pretends that he doesn't even exist. A year goes by and nothing. 2 years go by and nothing. And Absalom is just so shrewd. And when he thinks everybody's just kind of forgotten and everybody's kind of moved on, he decides to throw a big feast, invites the entire family, invites David. David's like, no, if I come, this whole entourage has to come. It'll be too much of a burden for your house. You know, just he's like, well, is it okay if I invite all my brothers? He's like, sure, knock yourself out, have a great time. So Absalom has this big feast. He gets everybody good and drunk, and he gets his brother really drunk. And all the brothers and the families are gathered around these tables. And then he sends his men into the dining hall, and they kill his brother. They just slaughter him right there in front of the brothers and their families. Everybody heads out different directions. All the brothers run back to Jerusalem. And Absalom gets up and he flees north to what we would call Syria. What King David finds out what his oldest son has done, or what his son has done, that his oldest has been murdered by what we find out later is his favorite son. And again, King David does nothing. And life just goes on. 3 long years pass. Things have settled down. Life goes back to normal. David's missing Absalom. So he sends messages. He invites Absalom to come back. You're invited to move back in your home, but he comes back. But then when he gets the king, the message is the king refuses to meet with you. You can come back, but the king refuses to meet with you. And for the next 2 years, Absalom tries to get in to see King David, and the king refuses. He ignores him, and Absalom is furious. He's like, you brought me back here, but it's like I'm under house arrest. I can't talk to you. I can't even get a message to you. And he got angrier and angrier, and finally he's just fed up. Now, Joab, he is the commander of David's forces, his armies, and oftentimes he was the go-between to get messages to the king. And so Absalom sends one of his servants to one of Joab's fields, says, go and set it on fire. And so he does. And then it gets put out. Joab's like, what the heck? Who did this? Finds out it's Absalom. He shows up, and Joab goes over. He's like, what the heck, dude? And Absalom says, nice to finally see you. I've been trying to get a message to you and my father for 2 years, and you have ignored me. So now that I have your undivided attention, will you please tell my father I want to meet with him? So Joab kind of jumps through some hoops. He makes it happen. David is able to go see the king. He bows down before the king. David lays his hands on Absalom, and which is his way of saying, you are forgiven, and our relationship is restored. But the reality is, it's not. And Absalom is hurt. And as far as the best that we know, David never calls for his son again, and Absalom breaks. He's angry and hurt, so he decides to overthrow his father, to take the throne for himself,
And he just, again, he was so shrewd. So early every morning, he would go set up a table, basically set up court outside the city gate. And as people were coming in to see the king to get justice for some cause, he would say, hey, let me help you. So he sets himself up as a judge. And day after day after day for 4 years, he would just invite them to come, I will hear your case, I'll make a decision. And these are people loved it. Because normally it would take weeks or months to be able to get before the king to have your case heard. And people recognized how smart he was, how wise he was, what a great leader he was. And Absalom stole the hearts of the people. And then 4 years later, he sets his plot in motion to overthrow his father. Then Absalom sent secret messengers throughout the tribes of Israel and said, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpets, then say and announce, Absalom is king in Hebron. So in other words, he sends all these messengers into these primary cities. It says at a certain time, at a certain day, you're just going to run through the city and you're going to announce, Absalom is king. Absalom is king. And this was a time period where there were no newspapers, no radio, no quick communication, no cell phones, nothing. So basically, people would just believe whatever they heard. And maybe Absalom's king because David died. Maybe Absalom's king because David just abdicated and gave Absalom the throne. So when people heard that Absalom had become king and that he had their hearts, they rejoiced. They celebrated, even though it actually hadn't happened. So 16 years after his incident with Bathsheba, 16 years, David's world would turn upside down. His firstborn has been murdered by his favorite son, who has now instigated a civil war that's about to divide an entire nation. A messenger came to David. The hearts of the people of Israel are with Absalom. And David is not completely surprised. I mean, he had heard rumors, certainly over the last couple of years, about what his son was doing. The text says, then David said to all of his officials and everyone who was with him in Jerusalem, come, we must flee, or none of us will escape Absalom. We must leave here immediately, or he will move quickly to overtake us and bring ruin on us and put the entire city to the sword. David knew, if I stay behind and put up a fight, and defend the city, and Absalom takes the city, he will assume that everybody within this city has sided with me, and he will kill every single one of them. So David abandons the throne to save the city. And once again, he's a fugitive. But this time, he's not 22. This time, he's 61 years old. This was not the dream. This is not the way he imagined spending this season of his life. This is not the way that this was not what he expected. His dreams were not coming true. They could not come true. And there we are. At some point in our lives, for every single one of us, the past, now, or in the future, this is where our story intersects with David. Because at some point, we take an inventory of our life. Maybe it's in our 20s, our 30s, our 40s, certainly in our 50s and 60s. And beyond, and we think, this was not how I imagined it. This was not how I planned it. And at times, we're heartbroken. We're disappointed. Maybe we're angry. We're frustrated with God. Maybe we're looking for somebody to blame. Maybe we want to blame God. After all, where is God? He could have kept this from happening. He could have made my plans play out. It was a good plan. So what's the point of going on? Why even try? It's like, God, I've hung in with you year after year. I've hung with him year after year, her year after year, and look what they've done. Look what they've done. Or you've waited and you've waited, but it's like, what did I wait for? Or you raised him right, or you raised her right, and you don't deserve to be treated this way. It's look at the way he's treating me. Look at the way she's treating me. And it's if you're honest, you say, I tried to do the right thing. I tried to do things the right way. I was told if I'm honest, if I work hard, if I do things a certain way, if I work hard, good things will happen. I was honest, I lost that job. I worked hard, I didn't get that promotion. And this is where oftentimes we can make things worse for ourselves because whatever the circumstance is, we find ourselves so frustrated and so angry, so hurt, so disappointed with God. And we end up making decisions that hurt ourselves, which eventually hurt people that we love, which creates more regret or more debt. And there's more pain relievers, yet there's more pain. And David, the first time he fled the kingdom, he took matters into his own hands, but he learned a lesson. He learned a lesson we all need to take to heart. So this whole caravan of David's is leaving, all of his family, all of his family's family, those that are loyal to him, they're leaving the city. Anybody that's a supporter, they're filing out. They're just trying to get out of Jerusalem before Absalom and his men arrive. And the whole countryside wept aloud as all the people passed by. The king also crossed the Kidron Valley, and all the people moved toward the wilderness. So David doesn't even know where they're going. All he knows is, I've got to get these people out of here. And Zadok, the high priest, Zadok was there too, leaving the city of David and all of the Levites. So this is the tribe that takes care of all of the sacrificial system for the Jewish people who were with him, and they were carrying the Ark of the Covenant of God. Now we read these stories, we read them too quickly, and we miss the significance of this. The Ark of the Covenant of God represented the presence of God. So in their mind, in ancient Israel, you could not be any closer to God than when you were in the presence of the Ark. And for some, it was like a good luck charm. You know, if we've got the Ark of the Covenant with us, when we go into battle, we are sure to win. And so when the people were in the city, they're watching everybody leave, and they see the Ark of the Covenant leaving. It's almost as if the presence of God is leaving the city with David. But David decided, this feels manipulative. So then the king says to Zadok, take the Ark of God and go back to the city. Now, the people who were with David, I'll guarantee you, when he said this, groaned. Because for them, what gave them courage and confidence was that they were following the king and they were following the presence of God. But listen to David's powerful explanation as to why they needed to take it back. If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, I'm not going to try and manipulate God. I'm not going to try and control outcomes. If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back. And he will let me see it in his dwelling place again. If God chooses, I'm not going to take matters into my own hands. But if he says, I'm not pleased with you, then I'm ready. I'm ready for either result, but God gets to decide. And here's the punctuation. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him. And this is the lesson. Not my will, thy will. Not my will, your will. Because every time I do my will, I mess things up. I make them more complicated. Every time I have my way, I get in the way. And this lesson is so powerful. Though David lost his world, he did not lose his confidence in God. David's entire world is upside down, yet he does not lose his faith in God. He doesn't reject the law of God or consider himself above the law of God, even though he's king. David understands he's flawed. He's an imperfect man. But he chose not to abandon God, even when it appeared that God had chosen to abandon him. Absalom shows up at the city, takes the city without a fight, but it's a hollow victory because he's taken the capital, but he doesn't have the king. And the only way to proclaim himself as the undisputed king is to kill his father. So he's in the capital, he's setting up shop in the palace, trying to decide what to do. In walks another character, his name is Ahithophel. And as far as we know, Ahithophel is Bathsheba's grandfather. He's one of David's trusted advisors, but he stays back at the palace. David leaves. When Absalom shows up, Ahithophel's there with a welcoming mat saying, "Greetings, welcome. As I was here to advise your father, I will be here to faithfully advise you." And Absalom says to Ahithophel, "All right, awesome. What should I do next?" And Ahithophel's advice is, do not rest. Gather all of the men that you have. Pursue your father immediately. Do not let him get organized. Do not let him gather more people around him. He is tired. He's hungry. They left in a hurry. They're not ready. They haven't set up any kind of defense. If you leave now, you will catch him and you can kill him. And when you kill him, all of those that left this city with him, they will recognize you as a king, and they will follow you back in this city, and you will become king of Israel. But there's another counselor as well. His name is Hushai. Now, Hushai, he had actually left the city with David, but when David realized that Ahithophel had stayed back in the city, he says to Hushai, he says, "Hey, I need you to go back. I need you to go back. I need you to greet my son when he comes in. And I need you to pretend to be a good advisor. I need you to frustrate the plans of Ahithophel, because here's the deal. Ahithophel is going to give good advice. I need you to give bad advice." So Absalom meets Hushai. He says to him, "You've heard Ahithophel's advice to me. What do you recommend?" And Hushai says, the advice that Ahithophel, yeah, it's not easy to say, has given, it's not good at this time. I mean, think about it. You know your father and his men. They are fighters. He may be 61, but do not be fooled. Your dad is a fighter. He's a killer. And they're fighters. They are as fierce as wild bears robbed of their cubs. Besides, your father is an experienced fighter. He will not spend the night with the troops. Even now, he's probably hiding in a cave or some other place. In other words, don't listen to Ahithophel. Just take a moment. Gather, consolidate, get a larger army, get all the tribes around you and behind you. And then once that's all done, then you can personally lead the campaign to take you, overthrow your father. And Absalom thought this was great advice. But Ahithophel knew if David was given time to organize and gather an army, there would be no way he could be defeated in open combat. So you know what he did? Ahithophel went home and he hung himself. I'm telling you, you should read this. So David and those with him, they make their way to another city, and he hears that Absalom and his forces are coming for him. He's like, okay, I have no choice. I've got to defend the people that are with me. So David does a very smart thing. He divides the army up into thirds. He puts commander over each of the thirds, and then he gives them very specific, explicit instructions. He says, when you catch up with Absalom's army, with Absalom, be gentle with the young man Absalom for my sake. In other words, I realize this is war, but if there is a way to spare my son's life, spare my son's life. And all of the troops heard the king giving orders concerning Absalom to each of his commanders. So everybody knew, if you find Absalom, you take him alive, you bring him to the king. And David's generals insist that David not join them in the battle. He stays back, watches from the walls, and for whatever reason, we don't know exactly why, but the battle doesn't take place in the open field. It ends up in the forest. And what that meant was superior numbers meant very little. Experience, communication, organization mattered more. And again, we don't know why the battle took place in the forest, but David's men were better organized because they had three commanders that were communicating. And the problem was that his son, everybody was looking to him and his army for communication. So the text tells us that Israel's troops were routed by David's men. And the casualties that day were great. 20,000 men died. The battle spread out over the whole countryside, and the forest swallowed up more men that day than the sword. Now, for many of you, you read this, and you think Lord of the Rings and the Ents, right? And it's like, oh, a tree beard, you know? But it wasn't that. It's like low-hanging branches and roots, soft spots, whatever. But eventually, Absalom is caught, and instead of being taken prisoner and being brought back to David, Joab has he and his guard slaughter his son. And then once the people know that Absalom is dead, Absalom's army immediately stops fighting. They drop their weapons, and the text tells us they just go home. And David is told that Absalom is dead. He mourns the loss of his favorite son. This was not the plan. This was not the plan that I had for my favorite son's life, whom I loved. My plans, my dreams will never come true. And he mourns the loss of his son. In fact, he mourns to such a degree it begins to embarrass his men for winning. They're almost embarrassed to celebrate their victory. Joab goes into David, says, what's wrong with you? You're mourning the loss of your son, and your men feel like it's as if they lost. Your men feel like it's as if you wish they died instead of your son. Your men just gave you back your kingdom. Now go out to the city gate and celebrate this victory, or by sunset, you will not have a single man left in your army. And so he does it. But it's a hollow victory for David because he loved his son Absalom. He ends up returning to Jerusalem as the king, but his life, his rule, nothing would ever be the same. And 9 years later, he dies at the age of 70. Now, it speaks to the authenticity of this account, because it's like the biographer doesn't leave any detail out about how flawed, how broken David was. He does nothing to hide David's faults and failures and flaws. And the thing that I want us to all take away from this narrative as we wrap up this series is that with all of his flaws, David never lost his confidence in God. And when things didn't go his way and it was somebody else's fault, when things didn't go its way and it was his own fault, with all of that, he never lost confidence in God. And even with this somewhat sad ending, it reminds us of something extraordinarily important, and this is our takeaway. That the foundation of my faith, the foundation of, if you are a person, you have faith, the foundation of our faith is not answered prayer or happily ever after endings. It's always a mistake to wrap up our faith and confidence and God around circumstances, the fulfillment of dreams, and even answered prayers. My dreams came true. God is great. My dreams didn't come true. There is no God. It's always a mistake, because dreams that don't come true and prayers that don't get answered say nothing about the presence or the goodness or the faithfulness of God. They say nothing about the activity or the lack of activity of God. David would be the quickest to remind us that when circumstances don't go our way, when dreams can't come true, to assume from circumstances that God is not real or that God is not present is a mistake. Instead, he would invite us to do what he did. He's on the run. All hope is gone. He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know if he'll ever see the city again. This is not what he dreamed would happen this late season in life. And he says, if I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him. In other words, the lesson is to say, not my will, thy will. I may lose my world, but I will not lose my confidence in God. I will not lose my faith in God. I choose not to abandon God, even when it appears that God has abandoned me. And from the line of David, about 1,000 years later, would come one who was flawless. He was flawless. He was sinless. And he lived a life faithful to God. And yet he would experience a moment where he would cry out, my God, my God, why have you forsaken me? One of the powerful things in following Jesus is, one of the New Testament writers puts it, is that for we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, with our struggles, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace in our time of need. Jesus is our advocate. And Jesus is the one who once begged God to change his circumstances. If there is any way for this cup to pass from me, like God, any other option but this one, if you're willing, take this cup from me. Jesus, who followed in the line of David, who pleaded with God about his situation, but even after all of that, Jesus showed him that even for he had a moment where he felt forsaken. But he discovered he was mistaken. I'll invite the band on up as we wrap up this series. As we look to Jesus, who again followed in the line of the man that we've been studying over the last few weeks, who lived the best, who lived faithfully to God, where he felt forsaken, who lived a life that in spite of what happens around me, whatever the circumstances, no matter how scary, how terrifying, that I'll remain faithful to God, who would say, not my will, but thy will be done. It's just fitting that we would celebrate this. And you might think communion isn't a celebration, but it's more than just a remembrance of like, oh, this happened in history, and so we'll just remember it. Now, the celebration comes, as again, the writer of Hebrews, is that we can celebrate that we have what he refers to as a high priest, that individual that intercedes between on our behalf, between us and God. And so he understands the struggle. He understands fear. He understands when things seem to be spinning out of control. And so he instituted this with his closest friends and followers, what we refer to as communion, what we're going to share together now, is one of the greatest symbols that when things seem to be spinning out of control and plans don't seem to be going as we wished, that God has something bigger in mind. And so as we take the elements, the bread pieces that represent the body, as Jesus said, this represents my body that is broken for you, and the cup that represents the blood that was shed because God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that for any of us that would believe in him and put the weight of our life in him and put our trust in him and let that relationship influence our decisions and how we treat people and how we handle everything around us, that we would be called his brother and be called children of God, and that it is his sacrifice that saves us And as been said, is if somebody will die for you, they are for you. And so I'm going to pray. And then if you just need a moment, because all of us have different things going on in our lives. Some of you are real mountaintop experiences right now and everything's great. And others of you, you got some stuff right now. You don't know what's coming around the corner and it kind of freaks you out a little bit. But wherever that is, this is just a moment to calm your spirit and to put the focus on Jesus, who becomes the foundation and the rock and that solid place, no matter what the storm, whatever the question. And when you're ready, you can go back and you can take the elements, or you can go off to the side and pray, or bring them back to the seat, however you want to do it. And then once everybody's had an opportunity to take communion, you just come back to your seats and then we'll wrap up. So, Father, I thank you for this morning. I thank you for those, many of them, that it cost them their lives to be able to get us so much of the text that we have, text that we included in what we refer to as the Bible, to be able to know history, to know the stories, and be able to learn from them. And right now, Father, the focus of this moment is the descendant of David, your son, Jesus, and what was given for us because you loved us with no guarantee that we would love you back. So in this moment, it's us coming back to that center, that Jesus and his resurrection is the thing that gives us hope no matter what our circumstances, and gives us freedom no matter how trapped we may feel. And so for I pray for every single one of us in this room, wherever we're at, God, that you would just bring us to that you would calm everything else. And that we would walk out of here, Father, with a refreshed mindset, that whatever we walk out of here facing today, you are in the middle of it. You are active. You know